All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that more extended interview with Rick Rule. We are going to continue to focus more on the resource sectors. We are now chatting with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, usually we talk more macro data, some economics, as well as tie it into the markets, but I want to stick to more the resource sector here, and I want to start off with the gold mining stocks. It was a couple of years ago that you coined the term the bang stocks, which referred to Barrick, Agnico, Newmont, Goldcorp as what could take over from the high-flying tech stocks. Now, the problem that we have seen, unfortunately, recently is that gold continues to hang right around $2,000. It has made a couple all-time weekly and monthly and quarterly closing highs. However, these bang stocks, the major miners, they continue to struggle. These majors, some are either at or near 52-week lows. Well, I think a lot of other investors are looking at other sectors saying, well, look at the markets. The markets are doing well. Jesse, make sense of this. Why are the gold stocks in this higher gold price environment still broadly ignored, it seems like?
Well, I think we have to really dial down into what is working well. And literally the only thing that's working well right now are AI stocks. The relative performance of everything else is pretty terrible. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about, look at the small caps, right? Small cap relative performance has been horrendous. But, you know, you look at all of the cyclically sensitive stocks within the market, and it's the same thing. Essentially, I think what we've seen, the markets have fully come to, we've had, you know, Magnificent Seven working well, but mainly even within those, it's been Nvidia and Microsoft, the ones that are AI focused, that have done well. Things like, you know, Tesla has rolled over, you know, pretty hard. Apple has struggled. Alphabet disappointed. So even some of the Magnificent Seven are starting to struggle some. But I think what we've done over the last really 6 to 9 months in the stock market, or just markets generally, is fully price in this soft landing narrative where inflation comes down to the Fed's target without creating a recession, right? So we're taking hard landing off the table. We're not going to see a recession, and we're not going to see persistent inflation. This is what the kind of the markets have come to discount. So if you believe that, right, how do you express that view as an investor? You say, okay, great, well, I'm going to buy all these high flying tech stocks because interest rates are going to come way down again, and we're going back to that pre-pandemic paradigm where what works are the fastest growing stocks in the market, and the valuations continue to go to the moon because the discount rate is so low. At the same time, why do I need to own anything that acts typically as a hedge against higher inflation or a hedge against a hard landing in the economy? You know, things like precious metals, you know, or any of these, anything else for that matter, you know, that might do well under, a non-soft landing. So I really think that helps kind of explain what's driven the markets, is we've now fully priced in a soft landing. And we, you know, with this CPI report this week, we're starting to see, you know, kind of some chinks in the armor of that narrative.
Well, Jesse, it is a great point that there really isn't an impetus for people to jump into something like precious metals if they believe that the Fed can take a victory lap, that we've tamed inflation, and that we have the soft landing narrative. Also, with the indexes, the S&P, the Dow, and the NASDAQ shooting to all-time highs, there's just not a lot of reasons for people to jump into gold equities. You made the point before this call, though, that the three most hated sectors are the precious metals, the energy space, and Chinese equities. So maybe tie that in too, just that it's not only something that people aren't paying attention to, they almost just don't even like these sectors at all right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one question I like to ask myself regularly, is it's almost kind of a Snow White thing, so a mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the most hated stock of them all, you know? And because you usually get some interesting opportunities when you think about that. I think for me, it's a three-way tie between these three things. It's the precious metals mining stocks. It's oil and gas producers. the Chinese equities. All three of these have gotten to the point where investors consider them uninvestable, you know, and that's usually a very good contrarian signal, very bullish signal that everybody who's wanted to sell these things has pretty much had the opportunity and now sold them. And there's not a lot of sellers left out there. And so what does that mean? It means any types of, you know, changes, you know, in these narratives, that something a little bit less bearish, a little bit something, you know, more bullish is going to change sentiment towards these things and change the investor, you know, demand for them, and people, you know, start buying them, and that's how you form a bottom in these kinds of things. So, you know, I think just from purely a sentiment standpoint, you know, they look very attractive. From a valuation standpoint, you know, I'm looking at stocks that trade, you know, literally 2.5 times enterprise value to EBITDA in the energy space. I mean, incredibly cheap, 7-8 times free cash flow. For some of the bigger majors, which is ridiculous to get, you know, 12-13%, you know, free cash flow yield, amazing when the broad stock market is trading at a, you know, a Shiller Cape ratio of 30+. So I think there's, you know, we could be at an important inflection point here, where if we start to see more kind of, like I said, chinks in the armor of this soft landing narrative, we start seeing maybe more signs that inflation is more persistent than investors expect, like the recent CPI report, or, you know, more evidence that we could be that a hard landing is more likely than markets currently price. You'll see a shift in demand in these things, right? I mean, you know, the CPI report, I thought, was very, very bullish for things like the energy space and precious metals space. That if it turns out inflation is persistent and the Fed, you know, hasn't done enough, investors are going to need to own more things like energy and precious metals to hedge against that risk.
Let's balance this out then, Jesse, because again, precious metals prices, or at least the gold price, is doing okay. And the oil price, it's been flat, kind of boring in a sense, but it's still in the 70s, but it's the underlying stocks that aren't doing well. And when you look at the gold miners, is there anything these gold mining companies can do to change the perception? Because if we do see inflation tick back up, it's been one of the arguments we've heard over and over and over again, is that inflation is hurting these gold miners because it's causing their prices to rise. So they're not getting that margin expansion.
Yeah, well, what we're likely to move towards, and I think, you know, we had some talk about this when inflation really started to pick up, you know, a couple of years ago. But I think that if we still see another wave of inflation, and I think that's a real possibility now with signs of a wage price spiral, right? We saw this in the latest CPI report that the supercore inflation is, you know, very strong, which suggests that the rise in goods inflation created this, you know, kind of a need for employees to say, I need a raise. And now that rising wages is creating kind of a, you know, a positive feedback loop for inflation. It's going to create a situation where either the Fed has to keep rates, you know, elevated much longer than people expect, which raises the prospect of a hard landing for the economy, right? If the Fed has to keep rates at 5.5 throughout this year, and with the rising, you know, problems we're seeing in commercial real estate and the banking sector and things, and with as much debt needs to, you know, be refinanced, the prospect of a hard landing just continues to grow. But at the same token, you know, if inflation proves more, you know, the opposite of transitory, which is very persistent and stubborn and difficult to deal with, and it looks like the Fed is going to have to raise rates higher to deal with it, there's going to be a real problem, because the federal government can't afford higher interest rates. The federal government can't even afford for rates to stay, very much like a lot of these private sector, you know, borrowers can't afford to refinance debt at current interest rates, that we're running into an area like this with the federal government as well. And so we might be forced into a situation where inflation remains persistent and the Fed has reached its limits of its abilities to deal with it. That is the ultimate bull case for precious metals. That's the type of thing that would, when people start to get an inkling of this, we're going to see precious metals really take off to the upside. So that's what I talk about, the soft landing narrative. Once people start to really come around to the idea that inflation is more stubborn, you know, the gold price has just a ton of potential upside in front of it. And you know, to think the relative performance of the miners. We talked about this last time you had me on a month ago. The relative performance in the short run of the miners relative to the gold price. I'm talking over weeks and months, not over multiple years, but over the short run, that relative performance is a very good sentiment signal in itself. It really tracks very closely to the discount to the net asset value of something like the Sprott physical gold and silver closed-end fund, which now trades at, you know, I think 5.5-6% discount to its underlying assets, which is a very clear signal that sentiment in the precious metal space is about as bearish as it's been at any point over the past 10 years. So to me, that explains the relative performance of the miners too. The miners relative to the metal are very, very weak. That's a very strong sentiment signal that investors have gotten far too bearish. And as if we move forward through this year, and as I say, we find that inflation is not going to come down back to the Fed's target as easily as people expect, that's going to be very bullish for the gold price.
Yeah, Jesse, I think there are people in the industry that have said this is not just the worst sentiment that they've seen in the disconnect between the gold equities and the gold price, but some of the craziest valuations when you look at what ounces in the ground are being valued at, when you look at how producers are being valued, when you look at development stage companies. It's a pretty big divorce, since a lot of this seems to depend on if inflation will be sticky or not and how that will affect the soft landing narrative and the Fed policy. Let's just quickly get your thoughts on where inflation is coming from and why it may be stickier, because most people, Jesse, attribute to inflation to an increase in the money supply. But then during the pandemic, we heard all about supply chain issues, but there's also all of the fiscal spending that was going on during the pandemic that was fueling that, where they were sending people checks and sending businesses during the payment protection plan checks. So all that money was finally circulating, which we hadn't seen in the prior decade as all the money printing was going on. Is it money printing? Is it supply chain issues? Is it something else going on that's driving inflation? Is it wage growth? What's driving inflation and what may cause it to be stickier?
Well, I think the most important factor driving inflation right now may be the trend towards deglobalization, right? This idea that we don't necessarily want to ship all of our jobs over to China any longer, which is something we've done, you know, for 40 years now, and especially really in the last 20 years, that trend accelerated, the offshoring of production. That was probably the single greatest disinflationary factor for the economy of all of them. I mean, right, people point to technology and, you know, technology prices come down consistently. But I think it was really cutting labor costs that really allowed disinflation to persist in the way that it has over the last 20 years. So when you start to say now, okay, now we don't want to produce in China because there are geopolitical risks and all kinds of things, and frankly, political risks here in the United States growth towards populist politicians is purely in reaction to Americans being unhappy with the fact that the middle class has been shrinking for so long, and it's a big part of that trend is the offshoring of labor. So the trend towards deglobalization, reshoring of production, these types of things puts great strains on the labor market and helps to boost wages at the same time that we have the baby boom generation retiring. So you have this demographic side of it also. So the labor force is shrinking relative to the overall size of the population at the same time as we want to ramp up production. So all of this puts a huge demand on wages and the labor force. And so I think that's probably what we're seeing in things like super core inflation, which are showing, you know, a huge jump in essentially wages and service in the services sector of the economy. So I think that's probably the biggest factor that's going on, just demographics and deglobalization. That's a long-term trend, but it's really kind of making itself felt right now. And that really makes this inflation a lot stickier than just a gumming up of supply chains kind of thing like we saw during the pandemic.
Yeah, very interesting, Jesse. We definitely have seen some of the baby boomer generation post-COVID, even during COVID, leave the workforce, walk away. And that's what we were saying. Hey, younger people needed to get some of the better jobs. And well, here we are now. let's talk a little bit more about China, because look, China's probably one of the worst performing markets out there. Like you said, some of the worst performing sectors. We can look at China broadly, their market. They're having housing market issue. Their stock market is doing horribly. Their economic data is not doing well. Any chance China turns it around anytime soon?
You know, I think that also represents another inflation risk, right? I think, you know, we maybe don't appreciate enough how much the economic weakness in China has helped bring inflation, you know, back down over the last couple of years, or last year especially. That, you know, China's weak economy means, you know, weak demand for, you know, commodities and you know, lower price pressures around the world. So if the Chinese economy does get its act together, if they start to turn that thing around and create more demand for commodities and price pressures, you know, I mean, turn from outright deflation back to even just, you know, flatline, let alone even, you know, small amounts of inflation, that could exacerbate these other inflation issues that we're talking about. So I think, you know, the bearish sentiment towards China is more than expressed in its equity prices. You see single digit PE ratios, right? They're big tech stocks, you know, even there, you know, which are very similar to the, you know, big tech stocks here in the United States that are so popular with investors, trade at, you know, the widest discount to their American peers in history, right? By far. You know, you have a stock like Alibaba that trades, I think, you know, 8 times earnings or something, you know, when Amazon trades 80 times. And so it's a huge disconnect there. And it's a huge opportunity, I think, for investors who are willing to be contrarian.
Well, let's talk about one more contrarian space, and that is the energy sector, Jesse. We've talked about the three hated sectors being gold, Chinese equities, and the energy space. We've alluded to gold and China there. But on the equity side of the oil and gas industry, you mentioned the producers were not seeing very good valuations, but we've also seen oil stuck in a rut for really a long time now. It's been range trading between, let's say, the mid-60s and the mid-80s for years. There was that breakout in 2022, and it got up to 125 oil, and nat gas got up to $9, almost $10. But since then, not only has the energy prices corrected, but the energy equities have corrected. How do you see the setup for the balance of the year? Are there opportunities here, or is it just going to be stuck in molasses?
I think, you know, it's very interesting. I don't ever really kind of advocate for investors to kind of go copycat, you know, the big successful players. But I think it's interesting to look at what Warren Buffett has been doing over the last year or two. They've been selling down pretty much everything in Berkshire Hathaway investment portfolio, except for one thing. They've been buying 20 to 30 million shares of Occidental Petroleum every quarter for the last 2 years, right? That's pretty much all Berkshire's been buying is energy. So you have the most successful legendary investor alive, right? Who's clearly bullish on only one thing, and that's oil and gas producers. And then you have insiders at these companies who are continuing to buy shares. I mean, energy infrastructure stuff, you could still buy with that as, you know, a double digit dividend yield and some of the MLPs and things, right? You get, you know, 4% on a 10-year treasury, or you can get 11-12% in some of these MLPs. It's kind of mind-boggling to me. But even just in, you know, the oil and gas producers, like I said, some of the smaller players, there's one in particular, I look at High Peak Energy, where, you know, CEO has been buying, you know, significant amounts of stock, trades 2.5 times enterprise value to EBITDA, and they've been growing production. They've been actually growing EBITDA over the last couple of years, even with the oil price coming down. So it just tells you how hated this sector is when you have, you know, like a stock like High Peak or Oxy, you know, which Berkshire's been buying, that literally trades 7.5 times free cash flow in one of the most expensive stock markets we've seen. So, you know, these are the types of opportunities I look for, things that are hated by the average investor, hated, you know, clearly where bearish sentiment is just off the charts. And you have super smart investors and insiders, you know, continuing to kind of back up the truck and increase exposure. To me, it's you know, very indicative of interesting opportunities.
All right, Jesse, I want to bring this full circle just for a quick comment back on gold here. You outlined a number of reasons as to why you think gold, there could be just more investment interest in gold here. What's a possible price target for gold? How much higher could gold go?
Well, I'm looking back. There's a price analog. If you just overlay the last bull market from 2001-2 to 2011, just overlay that price chart over the bull market we've seen from 2016 or something, it suggests that this, for me, the price analog has been eerily accurate, right? It's essentially the echoes in terms of when price should move and when price should consolidate. It's been just like what we've saw in that previous bull market. So, you know, we're kind of in another consolidation phase right now, but it suggests that, you know, we could be very close to another big boom. Another interesting price analog I look at, and we've talked about before, is that 2018 to 2020, 2021 timeframe. You just kind of match up, you know, where we are in the monetary cycle, right? Last time the Fed was raising interest rates, Jay Powell was raising interest rates into 2018. Gold price bottomed in fall of 2018 and turned higher before the Powell pivot in the late 18, early 19. And we're kind of in a very similar time frame now where, you know, gold price bottomed 5-6 months ago-ish. And now we're kind of, we've seen that, you know, Powell has said we're pretty much done with rate hikes. We're just waiting on when it's time to start cutting. The Fed started cutting in 19, or, you know, reversed QE in 19 in reaction to the repo fiasco. The longer they keep interest rates here at this 5.5, the closer we're going to get to some type of episode like that, which forces another major pivot in monetary policy. So I think it's very interesting to look back at that 2019 timeframe as to what is gold price going to do over the next 12 to 24 months, because it's probably something like it did in 19 when we did run into problems with interest rates being too high for too long.
All right, Jesse, thank you very much for your time. It's always interesting chatting with you, and hey, I appreciate our monthly calls. So we will chat again next month. Everybody, thanks for tuning in to this weekend's edition of the KE Report. Just a reminder, go back through the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast the KE Report to listen to all the daily editorials and company updates we recorded throughout the week. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.